Chapter 42. Experienced workers were entrusted with the delicate art of shaping and trimming the hat, and the forewoman still held her inexorably to the routine of preparatory work. She began to rip the spangles from the frame, listening absently to the buzz of talk which rose and fell with the coming and going of Miss Haynes' active figure. The air was closer than usual, because Miss Haynes, who had a cold, had not allowed a window to be opened even during the noon recess, and Lily's head was so heavy with the weight of a sleepless night that the chatter of her companions had the incoherence of a dream. I told her he'd never look at her again, and he didn't. I wouldn't have, either. I think she acted real mean to him. He took her to the Arion Ball, and had a hack for her both ways. She's taken 10 bottles, and her headaches don't seem no better, but she's written a testimonial to say the first bottle cured her, and she got $5 and her picture in the paper. Mrs. Treanor's hat? The one with the green paradise? Here, Miss Haynes, it'll be ready right off. That was one of the Treanor girls here yesterday with Mrs. George Dorset. How'd I know? Why, Madam sent for me to alter the flower in that veret at the Blue Tull. She's tall and slight, with her hair fuzzed out a good deal like Mamie Leach, on thinner. Dot dot. On and on it flowed, a current of meaningless sound, on which, startlingly enough, a familiar name now and then floated to the surface. It was the strangest part of Lily's strange experience, the hearing of these names, the seeing the fragmentary and distorted image of the world as he had lived and reflected in the mirror of the working girls' minds. As he had never before suspected the mixture of insatiable curiosity and contemptuous freedom with which she and her kind were discussed in this underworld of toilers who lived on their vanity and self-indulgence. Every girl in me, Regina's workroom, knew to whom the headgear in her hands was destined, and had her opinion of its future wearer, and a definite knowledge of the latter's place in the social system. That Lily was a star fallen from that sky did not, after the first stir of curiosity had subsided, materially add to their interest in her. As he had fallen, as he had gone under, and true to the ideal of their race, they were awed only by success, by the gross tangible image of material achievement. The consciousness of her different point of view merely kept them at a little distance from her, as though she were a foreigner with whom it was an effort to talk. Miss Bart, if you can't sew those spangles on more regular, I guess you'd better give the hat to Miss Kilroy. Lily looked down ruefully at her handiwork. The forewoman was right. The sewing on of the spangles was inexcusably bad. What made her so much more clumsy than usual? Was it a growing distaste for her task, or actual physical disability? She felt tired and confused. It was an effort to put her thoughts together. She rose and handed the hat to Miss Kilroy, who took it with a suppressed smile. I'm sorry. I'm afraid I am not well, she said to the forewoman. Miss Haynes offered no comment. From the first, as he had augured ill of me, Regina's consenting to include a fashionable apprentice among her workers. In that temple of art, no raw beginners were wanted, and Miss Haynes would have been more than human had she not taken a certain pleasure in seeing her forebodings confirmed. You'd better go back to binding edges, she said dryly. Lily slipped out last among the band of liberated workwomen. She did not care to be mingled in their noisy dispersal. Once in the street, she always felt an irresistible return to her old standpoint, an instinctive shrinking from all that was unpolished and promiscuous. In the days, how distant they now seemed. When S. he had visited the girls' club with Gertie Farish, S. he had felt an enlightened interest in the working classes. But that was because she looked down on them from above, from the happy altitude of her grace and her beneficence. Now that she was on a level with them, the point of view was less interesting. She felt a touch on her arm, and met the penitent eye of Miss Kilroy. Miss Bart, I guess you can sew those spangles on as well as I can when you're feeling right. Miss Haynes didn't act fair to you. Lily's color rose at the unexpected advance. It was a long time since real kindness had looked at her from any eyes but Jordy's.
Oh, thank you.
I'm not particularly well, but Miss Haynes was right. I am clumsy. Well, it's mean work for anybody with a headache. Miss Kilroy paused irresolutely. Why, you ought to go right home and lay down. Ever try orangeine?
Thank you.
Lily held out her hand. It's very kind of you, I mean to go home. She looked gratefully at Miss Kilroy, but neither knew what more to say. Lily was aware that the other was on the point of offering to go home with her, but she wanted to be alone and silent. Even kindness, the sort of kindness that Miss Kilroy could give, would have jarred on her just then.
Thank you, she repeated as she turned away.
She struck westward through the dreary March twilight, toward the street where her boarding house stood. As he had resolutely refused Jordy's offer of hospitality. Something of her mother's fierce shrinking from observation and sympathy was beginning to develop in her, and the promiscuity of small quarters and close intimacy seemed, on the whole, less endurable than the solitude of a hall bedroom in a house, where she could come and go unremarked among other workers. For a while less he had been sustained by this desire for privacy and independence. But now, perhaps from increasing physical weariness, the lassitude brought about by hours of unwonted confinement, she was beginning to feel acutely the ugliness and discomfort of her surroundings. The day's task done, she dreaded to return to her narrow room, with its blotched wallpaper and shabby paint, and she hated every step of the walk thither, through the degradation of a New York street in the last stages of decline from fashion to commerce. But what she dreaded most of all was having to pass the chemists at the corner of 6th Avenue. As he had meant to take another street. As he had usually done so of late. But today her steps were irresistibly drawn toward the flaring plate glass comer. She tried to take the lower crossing, but a laden dray crowded her back, and she struck across the street obliquely, reaching the sidewalk just opposite the chemist's door. Over the counter she caught the eye of the clerk who had waited on her before, and slipped the prescription into his hand. There could be no question about the prescription. It was a copy of one of Mrs. Hatch's, obligingly furnished by that lady's chemist. Lily was confident that the clerk would fill it without hesitation, yet the nervous dread of a refusal, or even of an expression of doubt, communicated itself to her restless hands as she affected to examine the bottles of perfume stacked on the glass case before her. The clerk had read the prescription without comment, but in the act of handing out the bottle he paused. "You don't want to increase the dose, you know," he remarked. Lily's heart contracted. What did he mean by looking at her in that way? "Of course not," she murmured, holding out her hand. "That's all right. It's a queer acting drug. A drop or two more, and off you go. The doctors don't know why." The dread lest he should question her, or keep the bottle back, choked the murmur of acquiescence in her throat, and when at length she emerged safely from the shop she was almost dizzy with the intensity of her relief. The mere touch of the packet thrilled her tired nerves with the delicious promise of a night of sleep. And in the reaction from her momentary fear she felt as if the first fumes of drowsiness were already stealing over her. In her confusion she stumbled against a man who was hurrying down the last steps of the elevated station. He drew back, and she heard her name uttered with surprise. It was Rosedale, fur-coated, glossy and prosperous, but why did she seem to see him so far off, and as if through a mist of splintered crystals? Before she could account for the phenomenon she found herself shaking hands with him. They had parted with scorn on her side and anger upon his, but all trace of these emotions seemed to vanish as their hands met, and she was only aware of a confused wish that she might continue to hold fast to him. "Why, what's the matter, Miss Lily? You're not well," he exclaimed, and she forced her lips into a pallid smile of reassurance. "I'm a little tired, it's nothing. Stay with me a moment, please," she faltered. That she should be asking this service of Rosedale. He
He glanced at the dirty and unpropitious cover on which they stood. With the shriek of the levated, and the tumult of trams and wagons contending hideously in their ears. We can't stay here, but let me take you somewhere for a cup of tea. The Lomworth is only a few yards off, and there'll be no one there at this hour. A cup of tea in quiet, somewhere out of the noise and ugliness, seemed for the moment the one solace she could bear. A few steps brought them to the lady's door of the hotel he had named, and a moment later he was seated opposite to her, and the waiter had placed the tea tray between them. Not a drop of brandy or whiskey first. You look regularly done up, Miss Lily. Well, take your tea strong, then, and, waiter, get a cushion for the lady's back. Lily smiled faintly at the injunction, to take her tea strong. It was the temptation she was always struggling to resist. Her craving for the keen stimulant was forever conflicting with that other craving for sleep, the midnight craving which only the little phial in her hand could still. But today, at any rate, the tea could hardly be too strong. She counted on it to pour warmth and resolution into her empty veins. As she leaned back before him, her lids drooping in utter lassitude, though the first warm draft already tinged her face with returning life, Rosedale was seized afresh by the poignant surprise of her beauty. The dark penciling of fatigue under her eyes, the morbid blue-veined pallor of the temples, brought out the brightness of her hair and lips, as though all her ebbing vitality were centered there. Against the dull chocolate-colored background of the restaurant, the purity of her head stood out as it had never done in the most brightly lit ballroom. He looked at her with a startled, uncomfortable feeling, as though her beauty were a forgotten enemy that had lain in ambush and now sprang out on him unawares. To clear the air, he tried to take an easy tone with her. "Why, Miss Lily, I haven't seen you for an age. I didn't know what had become of you." As he spoke, he was checked by an embarrassing sense of the complications to which this might lead. Though he had not seen her, he had heard of her, he knew of her connection with Mrs. Hatch, and of the talk resulting from it. Mrs. Hatch's milieu was one which he had once assiduously frequented, and now as devoutly shunned. Lily, to whom the tea had restored her usual clearness of mind, saw what was in his thoughts, and said with a slight smile, "You would not be likely to know about me. I have joined the working classes." He stared in genuine wonder. "Why, you don't mean? Why, what on earth are you doing?" Learning to be a milliner, at least trying to learn, she hastily qualified the statement. Rosedale suppressed a low whistle of surprise. "See, come off, you ain't serious, are you?" "Perfectly serious. I'm obliged to work for my living." "But I understood, I thought you were with Norma Hatch. You heard I had gone to her as her secretary?" "Something of the kind, I believe." He leaned forward to refill her cup. Lily guessed the possibilities of embarrassment which the topic held for him, and raising her eyes to his, she said suddenly, "I left her 2 months ago." Rosedale continued to fumble awkwardly with the teapot, and she felt sure that he had heard what had been said of her. But what was there that Rosedale did not hear? "Wasn't it a soft berth?" he inquired, with an attempt at lightness. "Too soft, one might have sunk in too deep." Lily rested one arm on the edge of the table, and sat looking at him more intently than as he had ever looked before. An uncontrollable impulse was urging her to put her case to this man, from whose curiosity she had always so fiercely defended herself. "You know Mrs. Hatch, I think? Well, perhaps you can understand that she might make things too easy for one." Rosedale looked faintly puzzled, and she remembered that elusiveness was lost on him. "It was no place for you, anyhow," he agreed, so suffused and immersed in the light of her full gaze that he found himself being drawn into strange depths of intimacy. He who had had to subsist on mere fugitive glances, looks winged in flight and swiftly lost under covert, now found her eyes settling on him with a brooding intensity that fairly dazzled him. "I left," Lily continued, "lest people should say I was helping Mrs. Hatch, to marry Freddie Van Osburgh, who is not in the least too good for her, and as they still continue to say it, I see that I might as well have stayed where I was. Oh, Freddie Rosedale brushed aside the topic with an air of its unimportance which gave a sense of the immense perspective he had acquired. F. Freddie don't count, but I knew you weren't mixed up in that. It ain't your style. Lily colored slightly. She could not conceal from herself that the words gave her pleasure. She would have liked to sit there, drinking more tea, and continuing to talk of herself to Rosedale. But the old habit of observing the conventions reminded her that it was time to bring their colloquy to an end, and she made a faint motion to push back her chair. Rosedale stopped her with a protesting gesture. W, wait a minute, don't go yet. Sit quiet and rest a little longer. You. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.